nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
As you know, till last week, what we had been discussing in the last few weeks has been this general approach that you could use to calculate the current voltage characteristics of any device. And the basic input that you need is this Hamiltonian. So you'd have to choose some grid or basis functions, figure out what H to use. Usually, if you know the dispersion relation, you might use a H that matches that EK relation. And once you have H, then there's a well-defined way that you could obtain the sigmas, this connection to the contacts. And once you have those two things, you can calculate electron density, current, anything you want. Those equations I'm not writing up, writing here to, not to clutter up the blackboard. But you have that if we know that. So the important thing is how to write these down. And as I've mentioned before, that one of the very powerful aspects of this method is that if you have set it up right and you do the calculations in a routine way correctly, then you should get the right answers. But it might take you a lot longer to actually understand what all that means. See? And in a way, later in this course, from now on, we'll basically be going through different examples, one by one, and trying to understand what you get. But in terms of calculating it, if you just set it up blindly, you should get it, really. Okay? And one of the first examples to go through, in fact, anytime I do a calculation on any new system, this is like the first thing I would try to do, and that is consider a ballistic conductor and calculate this conductance as a function of energy. That is, you assume in energy that, let us say, you only have electrons incident from here, nothing coming out here, and nothing incident from here. So F1 is 1, F2 is 0. So electrons come in from here and they go out this contact. It's just that nothing comes in from here because the chemical potential, let's say, is very low. Then you can see at different energies how much current you'd get. So in general, you might expect some function here. And that function would then tell you that at a given energy, if electrons came in from here, what you'd get out there. That's sometimes called the transmission of this thing. Now, in an actual problem where you have electrons incident from both sides, so you have a mu 1 and a mu 2, that's fine. Once you know this function, what it means is if mu 1 is here and mu 2 is here, then the current will basically be carried by these energies, the ones between mu 1 and mu 2. That we have discussed before. Understand? So important thing to calculate is this function. And the thing is that for ballistic conductors, if you have done it right, you'll get this series of steps. What you get is not this continuous curve, like I said, something that looks more like that. Of course, in real systems, there would always be some rounding, but the point is you can still discern these clear steps. And the steps go, like if you're looking at the transmission, like 1, 2, 3, etc., which corresponds to a conductance of 2q square over h, times 1, 2q square over h times 2, 2q square over h times 3, etc. And this is the result that, as I said, whenever I look at any new system, that's the problem I try to set up. Because unless you have done quite a few things right, you don't quite get this. You'll get funny stuff that won't look right. So this is always a good check if you have really set up the problem correctly. Before you try to put in impurities, roughness, anything else, first thing is to do the ballistic one to make sure it looks right. Okay. And this, as I mentioned before, this week basically in a way we have been talking about this problem, this thing. And as I mentioned before, in the development of this whole subject of understanding current flow in small conductors, this was a landmark experiment like 20 years ago. Because which kind of showed that there were these discrete modes that carry current in a way. This idea that this thing that it comes in, it steps. Okay. And the way we understand this, as I said, is that if you're doing this blindly, just setting this up, then what H would have looked like, if you had a 1D conductor, it would have looked something like this. A discrete lattice, like so. And whose diagonal elements? It's epsilon, and this nearest neighbor coupling is minus T. And we have discussed that in this case, your EK relation would have looked something like this, which you could adjust so that this bottom looks like a parabola. But for the discrete lattice, you get this cosine function, as you know. And then if you look at the corresponding transmission, you'd see a step. You basically get one. And this is a result you can prove analytically. You set this up using the NEGF equations, should come out just this. That we have discussed. And what we are trying to understand then, that's what we are going on with, is what if you had a two-dimensional conductor? So you now have a network of things. So it's like every point is connected to right, left, top, and bottom. And as I mentioned, in general then, with all these conductors, regardless of how complicated it is, if you have a preferred current flow direction, like, say, in this direction, then it's always convenient to think of this entire unit as one thing and call it an alpha that we have discussed. And then this coupling to it, that's what you call a beta. So, something like this then, you could visualize as a lattice with alphas connected by betas, like so. And again, as I mentioned, if you just set this up, you would get a bunch of steps. And of course, only the lower part is of interest here. Don't worry about the top part. So you'd see a bunch of steps like this. And that should come out if you have set it up correctly. And last day, what I was trying to explain is that this is something you could try to understand analytically by using this very powerful concept of basis transformation. The idea that, well, when I'm thinking of the matrix in this grid system, whenever I have a component of the wave function, you know, the wave function looks like a column vector. Each component represents the wave function at a particular point. So that's kind of my basis. So whenever I see a number here, it tells me the amplitude at that point. But the thing is, I can transform into any other basis also. And if I transform it into a different basis, then again, these components will look different. You'll have a whole different set of components now. And each one will now represent not the wave function at that point, but the wave function in some abstract space. I mean, could be a Fourier component, for example. So each component now represents something else after you have transformed it. And in that space, things could be decoupled and help you visualize the whole thing. So that's the example that I was going through last day. Namely, we say that let's write down alpha first. So in this problem, alpha would look like, I think for the 2D lattice, the diagonal elements are 4T. So that's a 4T. And then a minus T to the nearest neighbor. So it's a tri-diagonal matrix. 4T on the diagonal, minus T on the upper diagonal, minus T on the lower diagonal. That's what the alpha would look like. And the beta, that's what couples one column onto another. That's what would look like. minus t on the diagonals. And what else? Nothing, just zeros elsewhere. Why? Because beta represents the coupling from one column to the next. So these rows are then atoms on a particular column, and these are the atoms on the next column. And the thing is, every atom in one column is connected uniquely to one atom in the next one. So if you label these things 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, then the only connection is from 1 to 1, 2 to 2, 3 to 3, etc. And hence, this looks diagonal. That's the beta. And if I had to write the overall H matrix, that would have looked something like alphas on the diagonal, betas on the upper diagonal, and in general a beta dagger on the lower diagonal. In this case, of course, beta, beta dagger are all the same. But in general, because H has to be Hermitian, whatever appears here, you must have the conjugate transpose there. That's a just general rule. In this context, they're all both the same. Makes no difference. Okay. So these are the matrices. And the point I made last day was that you can use this idea of basis transformation to diagonalize this matrix. That is, you can find a unitary transformation such that this V dagger, alpha V, if you do that, this is this process of a unitary transformation in a special case of the similarity transformation. That is, in this case, we are only dealing with Hermitian matrix. Yeah? Okay, so if you use this V dagger, alpha V, then what you'd come out with is a matrix that would look purely diagonal, zeros also. And how do you obtain the V? Well, as I mentioned before, numerically, what the V would look like, the way you could get V is you go to MATLAB and say V comma D is equal to eigen of alpha. So if you give MATLAB the alpha matrix, it'll come back and give you all its eigenvalues on this diagonal matrix. And it will give you what's called this eigenvector matrix. This matrix whose columns, each column is an eigenvector. So corresponding to the first eigenvalue, the first eigenvector, and the second eigenvector. So it lists all the eigenvectors in terms of all these real space points, in terms of this lattice points I. So the columns are labeled by the eigenvector number. The rows are labeled by points here. So when I do this transformation, what does it really mean in terms of the wave functions now? It's like previously, every wave function told me the amplitude at a particular point. Now the wave function that I have in this new basis would actually represent the amplitudes of specific eigenvectors. That is, rather than think of the overall wave function as a superposition of something here, something here, something here, etc., you're thinking of it as something times an one eigenvector 1, something times eigenvector 2, etc. So this first eigenvector, if you looked at it, might look, say, something like this. You know, it's a little bit like a Fourier transform. I'll talk a little more about what this looks like. Like a Fourier transform. So this is like the lowest sine wave. Then the next one might look like that, etc. So what I mean is that when you do this unitary transformation, you're now thinking of things as, okay, I've got the wave function amplitude, so much amplitude in this first one and so much in the second one, and these are what you call the transverse modes, right? And or sometimes this is also very similar to what you'd call subbands. Now, the word transverse modes wasn't used much in this literature before. That's a terminology borrowed from microwaves, that in the case of waveguides, if you have taken a course like 604, you know that a waveguide has these modes, the TE11, TE21, etc. And in a way, these are kind of like that. These are electron waveguide modes. See? And it's just that before 1990 or so, nobody thought of conductors as waveguides. It's just that once that got small enough, that's when that word came around, when people started talking about electron waveguides, transverse modes. So that's where that word came from. Whereas usually in the device literature, normally people would have called it sub-bands probably. This would be in the, they're the kind of related concepts. Okay. Now, so mathematically then, though, all we are doing is finding this matrix so that we can transform alpha. Transform alpha into this new one. And, of course, as I mentioned, I always have to remember whether it's V dagger alpha V or V alpha V dagger. It's one of those. And the way I remember it is that alpha is in terms of real space points as it stands. Whereas I'm transforming it into the eigenspace points. And so this matrix, you see, whatever I have here must match what you have there. So this matrix must be listing eigenvectors in terms of real space points, which is exactly what V is. So I've got it right. Whereas the V dagger has eigen here and real space here. What it really gives you is a particular wave function at one real space point, what it is in terms of different eigenvectors. Whereas this one tells you what, this V tells you what each eigenvector is in terms of different real space points. You see? So if you had written V alpha V dagger, then the thing is the rows and columns wouldn't have matched. You'd have an I here and an E there. That wouldn't be right. Okay? So that's how I kind of keep track of what it is. And as I mentioned, one best way to get comfortable with this stuff is with MATLAB. You can really play around with this. You know, give it any Hermitian matrix and try it out. And you'd see, you know, V alpha V dagger, or which one did it? V dagger alpha V. V dagger alpha V should be equal to D. You say should be equal to this diagonal matrix. And if you do V alpha V dagger, in general, you'll come out with something looking like a mess. In general. I mean, every once in a while, V and V dagger happen to be the same thing for some simple things. But in general, yeah, if you do V alpha V dagger, it won't work at all. And of course, this V is a unitary matrix. What that means is that V dagger is actually equal to V inverse. And that's kind of convenient because, you know, finding the inverse of a matrix is a lot of work. Finding its conjugate transpose is relatively easy. And, of course, if V dagger alpha V gives you D, then you also know that the inverse transformation, which is alpha, is equal to VD V dagger. How do I know that? Well, you see, if I start from here, I could multiply with V dagger inverse from the left. That would take this out. But V dagger inverse is the same as V, so I got the V there. And from the right, I could multiply with V inverse, but then V inverse is V dagger, so that's there. So that's how you do it. Okay? So that's the inverse transformation. But the important thing is to have the right, you know, this one is V dagger and V, this is V and V dagger. And if you interchange them, you'll get nonsense. It won't be right at all. Okay? Okay. Anyway, so in this context then, the point is that this alpha had all kinds of off-diagonal stuff, which made it hard to visualize, because off-diagonal things in the matrix means connections like this. And when everything is interconnected, it's hard to see what will happen. You see, if you can decouple them, it's always much easier to visualize what happened. And the point is that if by going to this new space, this new using this unitary transformation, it becomes diagonal. Of course, if in the process this had become non-diagonal, you'd be in trouble. But as I've mentioned before, this one being an identity matrix in this model, in this particular problem, when you transform it, it still remains identity. So this, after you are done, still looks like a diagonal matrix. You know, same thing, minus t's. Okay. So what that means is that in this transformed basis then, you could think of it as just separate wires like so. Each one. And, but they're not identical wires though. Right? That's the point I want to make. What's different about them? Well, if you look at the beta matrix, it's the same for every element. So it's minus t everywhere. So each wire has a connection that looks like minus t. But what's different about each one? It's the diagonal element. Because you see, when I diagonalize this, I'll get a diagonal matrix, sure, but the elements of the diagonal will all be different. So you'll have different things here, you know, like alpha 1, alpha 2, different numbers, alpha n. And so each wire will have a different thing here. The diagonal element will be a little bit different for each one. So, but I'll have n separate wires. So if I had started with something that had, say, 10 rows like this, here also I'll have 10 modes, 10 separate things. But each one is a separate wire. And now you could write that the energy of each one in this wire, so let's say label my wires with this index nu. That's like nu equals 1, nu equals 2, etc. The corresponding EK relation would be, as you know, whatever's on the diagonal minus 2t cosine kA. So this first wire would have an EK relation looking like that. Second wire, again, same thing, but alpha 2, alpha 3, etc. And if I plot these out, what I'll see then is, let's see. So that's the E1, that's the nu equals 1. That's the lowest eigenvalue, alpha 1. And then you take the next higher eigenvalue, alpha 2, and alpha 3, and so on. So the next one will look like, etc. So we'll have a whole bunch of these way up here. So the great advantage, of course, is that this all became decoupled. So each one can do separately. Now, this simplification, though, that you have decoupled them, that only, again, holds as long as it's ballistic. Because if you had one impurity in there, you know, something that's like sitting in the middle here, that's then that thing would have actually, you know, how would you include it? You'd have to include it on the diagonal element. So one of these would have something in it, etc. And then when you transform it, you'll find it won't quite decouple so nicely. Of course, once you have impurities, you shouldn't be thinking in terms of EK relations anyway. But the point is, this decoupling, which comes from transforming to a different basis, anytime you have an impurity, you'll have various connections between them. What that means is, it means you could come in one subband, but then get scattered into another subband. That's what you'd call that, a scattering process. So impurity takes you from one subband into another. But ballistic problems, you know, each subband is separate. If you're in this subband, you just continue there. If you're in this subband, you just continue there, etc. And at a given energy, how many subbands you have, that's what determines the conductance you'll get. So if your energy happens to be here, then you'd have just one subband. If it happened to be here, you'd have two subbands. Happen to be here, you know, because these go on. If you're here, you might have three and then four and so on. And that was the experiment that I had mentioned, where people gradually change the location of the Fermi energy in a conductor. And what they saw was the conductance went down by steps, 4, 3, 2, 1, etc. And, yeah, okay. Now, one thing that we can talk about next then is, how would you write down these locations of these things? Where are these? Because if we know where these are, then for a given energy, we could tell how many subbands we'd have. Because we could say, well, how many of them are below here, for example. Count up. Now, now this is where there's this interesting rule that one can use. And that is, you see, in general, if I had a matrix like this and I'm trying to diagonalize it and find the new eigenvalues, I'd have to go to a computer. But if you have a matrix where every row looks the same, you see, this is 4t minus t minus t. And then again, next row is 4t minus t minus t. If every row looks the same, and if you use periodic boundary conditions, so what that means is when you get to the ends, of course, things look different. But let us assume that we are putting minus t's here also. So remember, what this alpha represents is a set of points like this. So let's say I got 4 points. And at the ends, of course, it just ends like this in the real case. So 4 is connected to 3, but there is no 5 there. I mean, there's a 5 that would have been there, but it's not there because it has ended. And there's no 0 here. It's like that. And so there's two ways of handling this boundary conditions that's very common. One is what's this called the box boundary condition. Box meaning you're saying that let's put the wave function to 0 at the two ends. You say there's a infinite potential well there, and that's what enforces a zero boundary condition. That's one. The other one, which is actually a little easier, is the periodic boundary condition. And that is you think of it as if they are, as if it's like a ring, as if the point 4 is right next to point 1. Okay? And when you try to calculate these energies, depending on which model you use, this one or the other one, or the box one or the periodic one, you'll get somewhat different answers. They're not exactly the same. They're somewhat different. But in big conductors, when you have lots of points, when you have a very big conductor compared to a wavelength, so lots of modes, basically, when you have lots of modes, then the two answers is hard to tell the difference. Both of them essentially go over to sort of an Ohm's law. What I mean is the number of modes is just proportional to the width. It doesn't matter too much exactly what boundary condition one uses. But when you go to small things, then the actual boundary condition matters. And you'll see in a lot of the literature in dealing with solids is that people often use this periodic boundary condition, which is like saying that although the real thing is like this, I'll assume it looks like that. And the justification normally is not that mathematically they are equivalent. They are not. The answers are different. But just that physically I know that if I am talking about a big conductor, then the properties shouldn't depend too much on exactly what's going on at the surface, at the two ends. And so it shouldn't matter what it is. So let me make my life mathematically simplest by doing this. That's the argument usually. Now, and so, but the real boundary condition is really often more like a box, really, where wave function has to go to zero at the ends. Now, the only example, though, the count where you really have periodic boundary conditions in practice is this example of carbon nanotubes, which we'll talk about after this, is that there is this material called graphite, and if you look at a layer of graphite, that's called graphene. It has got carbon atoms arranged in a certain way. And often it appears, and often it is available in a form where it forms a cylinder like this. So you call that a carbon nanotube. In fact, that's the form in which it was studied widely till last 2 or 3 years. And last 2 or 3 years, people have been actually studying even the sheet itself. That's called graphene. These are graphene nanoribbons. And so this is a case where people have actually made measurements both on a conductor with box boundary conditions and one with periodic boundary conditions. And the answers are different when you look at this small, when things are small.
Question, even if I have a system with many modes, if I have then two chemical potentials, one source and drain, and they are only slightly different, so that only a small number of modes contribute, would I see a difference then because the spacing in the modes is different depending on the boundary conditions?
Right. It's just that if the number that's different is, let's say, you know, in one way it is 10,003 and the other one is 10,004, then it's hard to tell the difference for one. And the other thing is that everything always gets averaged over energy, over an energy range of kT. So in a big conductor, these two are really close together. So let's say if you're chemical potential was around here, you had, say, 10,000 modes or 10,001 modes. And if you're here, let's say you have 10,000 modes. But then because kT averages it out, what you actually measure will probably be 10,000.5 anyway because of that averaging. It's only when you go to low temperatures so that kT is just that much. So kT is actually less than the spacing between subbands, that is when you really start seeing the integers, then, clearly.
Okay. But in that state, would I see a difference between those two boundary conditions?
Yeah, in principle, yes. Till recently, there was no experimental evidence because normally you don't get the periodic boundary condition. But the one conductor where you now have experimental evidence that you can measure both types is graphene and carbon nanotubes, and there is a difference. There's a clear difference, actually. Okay. Now, if you assume periodic boundary conditions, so the way this works is that if you assume periodic boundary conditions, then the eigenvalues of this matrix, the ones you're writing here, can be written as, now, this alpha nu can be written as whatever's on the diagonal right here minus 2t cosine ka and remember now that this k actually now refers more to this direction, whereas that k that we did, that we wrote there, that had to do with the prop current flow direction. K nu. And the thing is, with periodic boundary condition, this quantity has to be some multiple of 2 pi. No, did I write that correctly? No, 2 pi nu, actually, sorry, divided by the number of points. So the argument goes like this, that whenever you have a matrix of this type and you're trying to find its eigenvalues, what you're really doing is, trying to find solutions to an equation of this form that, say, E psi n is equal to the diagonal element minus t psi n minus 1 minus t psi n plus 1. Remember, you are trying to find the eigenvalues of this matrix. What that means is you are trying to find a column vector psi such that this time psi is equal to E psi, let's say. And if you wrote out the individual elements of that, it would have looked something like this. And the solution to this, as long as epsilons and t's are the same everywhere, by epsilon I mean these diagonal elements, then the solution to this, as you know, can be written as psi n is equal to e to the power I k n a. And that will automatically give you this. And the condition on K, that comes from requiring that because of the periodic boundary condition, anytime I add a capital N to this, I should get back the same number. What is capital N? It's the total number of points in my lattice. And because it's periodic, every time I go around by N points, I should be back at the same point. Right, we could put a constant in front. In general, these being linear equations, anytime you have a solution, you can multiply it by any with the number, right? Any complex number. You're right. So, and this would be consistent. If I put n equals 0, I do get that. So, yeah, this would be. Anyway, so this then is equal to this. So what that requires is that kna be equal to some multiple of 2 pi. And that's what leads to this condition, that Ka must be 2 pi times an integer divided by n. And so you could go through the integers, and that's how you'd find allowed values of K. So this is how you can write down the eigenvalues of this matrix without ever going to a computer. Now the difference, there's a slight difference in the case of the box boundary condition. You see, this one works nicely for periodic boundary conditions because even when you get to the last point, every point still has 2 neighbors. And so even the last point is really no different from any interior point. That's the nice thing about the periodic boundary condition. You see, because you have physically you have done this, all points are really the same. On the other hand, when you have a box boundary condition, the point is the 2 ends are different. Okay. And so, this solution won't quite work anymore. Okay. Now, what does work in this case is, instead of exponential, if you use sine. Now, the sine, of course, ensures that at n equals 0, it is 0. So, you know, so this is the box thing. I've got capital N points here, and I want the wave function to be 0 at 1, at the 0 point, like right outside it. So, I can take this out. Just to remind you of the picture we have. This is 1 down to N, and then there's a 0 point, or I think I labeled it the other way, but that's okay. So, N plus 1 point, and then there's a 0 point. So we are now putting the wave function to 0 here and wave function to 0 there. And so now you have to use this boundary condition, I mean this form of the wave function, and that will again automatically satisfy that entire set of equations. And the way you can show that is, you could put this together, E minus epsilon times psi n, which is sine kna, should be equal to minus t sine of k n minus 1 a plus sine of k n plus 1 a. You know, previously I was using e to the power I k n a, and with exponentials it's kind of easy to show that it works because, you know, just divide through by psi n, we have done that many times. With the sine, the algebra is a little more complicated. What I'm trying to show is, let's say I'm saying this is a solution, but how do you prove that it works? Well, substitute it. And if you substitute it, it's not quite obvious that the sines will cancel out as is. Okay? And the way you can show that is by using the sum formula. I think it's like sine a minus b plus sine a plus b is like sine A cosine B. See, if you use that, then you can, this will become sine KNA times cosine KA. And now you can see the sine will cancel out, and you'll then have E minus epsilon equals T cosine KA. Actually, I think there were 2 here. So 2T cosine K like before. So you can show easily sine works. Another way to argue would have been, well, exponential works, e to the power plus I works and minus I works, gives you the same E. So any linear combination will also work, hence should also work. So cosine would have worked also, just as well. Why am I excluding the cosine? Well, because of the boundary condition. This needs to be 0 at the two ends. Sine will be automatically 0 here. Will sine be 0 there? Well, yes, if I choose my k correctly. And that will determine which k's are allowed. So if I use that, the condition I'll get is, now, again, alpha nu equals this, same story, but the expression for k nu now is a little bit different. It's like k nu times na, or if I go to the n plus 1th point, it should be equal to some multiple of pi, not 2 pi, because in a sine function will be 0 every time it's a multiple of pi. And that gives you, so instead of k nu a being 2 pi nu over n, the box boundary condition gives you k nu is equal to pi nu over n plus 1. So that's the box case. That's the periodic one. And these are things you can check easily. You know, just if you just set up a tri-diagonal matrix like this, ask MATLAB to find the eigenvalues for you. So do it two ways. One is when you have box boundary conditions, so you have added nothing there. The other is do it with the periodic one. Put something there. The minus t, the same thing there. And in one case, you'll find the eigenvalues you get will be matching this. In the other case, it'll be matching that. See? And there's an interesting difference here. Here, each eigenvalue will be different because they correspond to values like nu equals 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. Here, you'll find the eigenvalues come in pairs. There'll be a nu equals plus 1 and a nu equals minus 1, a nu equals plus 2 and a nu equals minus 2. There'll be kind of twos. They'll come in twos. Here, they're spaced by, you know, pi over n plus 1. Here, it is 2 pi. So here, they're kind of further apart. But then, they come in pairs. Pairs because there's a plus and a minus. Here they come one. Here they come just one at a time, but they're a little closer together. Okay. So when you get to big conductors, then if you count up how many you have, you end up with roughly the same number. It's just that here they're spaced a little further apart, but then they come together, come in pairs. Here they are. But when you get to small things, that's when this little difference actually makes it can be seen. So, in, for example, in carbon nanotubes, when people measure the conductance of ballistic things, you know, as I've mentioned often, what you expect to see is 2 E squared over H. It's like E squared over H for every mode in a way, and the 2 is because this 2 spins. And that's what we'll be talking about next week, actually, about spins. So, 2 E squared over H is what you expect. But carbon nanotubes, when you measure the ballistic conductance, you actually get 4 E squared over H. Because the lowest subband often is like they come in twos. It's two. Because of this, again, periodic boundary condition, etc. Whereas when they look at graphene, often it's you don't get the 4 E squared over H. You're getting 2 E squared over H, etc. So these are all, it's always nice when you do all this much math. Every once in a while when you find something that's, you know, has a very direct experimental consequence and it gives you a lot more, lot warmer feeling about all the math you're doing, you see, because it sounds like it has got something to do with the real world. See? Okay. Now, so if you use this then, so that would be the box, this would be the periodic boundary condition, and this is how you'd end up with, you know, you can find where these levels would be, because if you write down, I guess I could take this off now, the way you find the bottoms of these bands, this one, this one, this one, is by going to this relationship and putting k equals 0. That's what will give you this point. If you want k equals 1, if you want k equals 0 for E nu, E1, it will be this one, E2 will be that one, etc. And so, in general, E nu at k equals 0 is alpha nu minus 2t. And the alpha nu itself, we agreed, would be something like this. 4t minus 2t cosine k nu a This k nu, as we said, depending on whether you are doing box or periodic, could be this or that. It's one of these. And this you can write as 2t times 1 minus cosine k nu a. And this, as I've often mentioned, to get the continuum result, what you could do is say, let's replace cosine theta with 1 minus half theta squared. That's this Taylor series expansion, if you, you know, set this to a small number. And then this would become more like t a square k nu square. I'm sorry, did I write that correctly? Okay. And in the, for large conductors, what happens is that you could ask that, well, how many do I have down here? How many modes do I have down here below a certain energy? So the way you think about it is, at this energy, you know, how many of these alphas would actually be below it? And suppose I could take this off. And this, you can see, would be directly proportional to the carrier density. Why is that? Because the more the electron density in here, the more the number of modes, the higher this energy would be. And in big conductors, the way you often think is that in K, this is KX, this is KY. This, let's say your states are spaced by 2 pi over L or 2 pi over W. And you ask the question that for a given carrier density at zero temperature, you know, what should the energy be so that you have the right number of states in here? Because each state can hold one electron, or if you include spin, two electrons. And so, just from the knowledge of the carrier density, you can usually write down the maximum k up to which it is filled. Maximum value of this k that you're allowed. And that is something that people often call the Fermi k. So it's like the area of this circle in two dimensions is pi f squared. And since each state occupies a space of 2 pi over L and 2 pi over W, this amounts to kf square over 2 pi times LW. Actually, that would be the total number of electrons. And if I divide out by the area, that would give me the electron density. So ns would be kf square over 2 pi. So at low temperatures, that's a very simple result to remember, actually. That for a given carrier density, what is the maximum k up to which states are occupied? And, you know, this k, if you do 2 pi over, you could, sometimes people write this as 2 pi over the wavelength. And that's what you call the de Broglie wavelength then, of electrons at that energy. So in a way, for this two-dimensional conductor, if you know that the carrier density is, say, 10 to the 12th per square centimeter, you could immediately figure out what this maximum k should be, kf corresponding to the Fermi energy, and corresponding to that, you could see what the de Broglie wavelength would be. And typically, it would come out about 100 angstroms or so for this, I believe, somewhere 100 or 200 angstroms. This you could check easily. Yeah? Yeah? Very good point, yeah. So his point is that, yeah, this should be 4 pi. What I did, kind of without saying much, is I figured in the spin. Because usually when you are trying to relate to carrier density, this includes spin, of course. You don't quote the carrier density per spin, right? Whereas, so spin is something, yeah, you have to remember to include it in the right places. Anyway, so that's what usually picks up a 2 there. And so the 2 and the 4, that's why I wrote the 2. Very good point, yeah. I've often not been, you know, very careful about this point, about when I include spin and when I don't. But, so in big conductors, that's how you find a KF. And then you can see that your allowed Ks are given by this relationship that K times W must be equal to some multiple of pi. And so then you can see what's the maximum K you could, you know, what is the biggest integer that you could accommodate, so that this allowed k's here, I mean, these are the k's that define these points, so that this does not exceed the kf, because the maximum is kf. So in a way, you could put kfw here, and then the integer you get, roughly, would tell you the number of modes. So another way of saying that is that, roughly speaking, this number of modes tells you like how many wavelengths actually can fit in that cross-section, or how many half wavelengths can fit in that cross-section. Here I'm kind of running out of time, so I'm not doing this very well, but I think you can fill in the details here. But broadly, the point I wanted to make is, just as with electromagnetic waveguides, you think of modes as thinking of how many half wavelengths fit. Here also you have a similar situation. It is just that, yeah, it's at low temperatures, you have this very clean result that right at the that current flow is due to electrons with a particular energy, which has a specific k and hence a specific wavelength. In general, there are many electrons involved. Each one has a different wavelength. So it's not as clean. It's averaged. Anyway, let me stop here today.